Okay, so now to introduce the person that's going to speak for us tonight, it's a big honor. About 8 months ago when I came into the rooms of AA, I remember going to Rule 62, being really scared my first meeting, and there was Alyssa, you know, so welcoming, so happy. Hi, how are you? My name is Alyssa, here's my number. And I left thinking, okay, people in AA are like this, I'm coming back. So it's my honor and privilege to introduce you to you guys, Alyssa.
My name is Alyssa and I'm an alcoholic. An extremely nervous alcoholic. And she almost made me cry already and I haven't even started talking. I brought my tissues just in case because I am a crier. And I've heard in the rooms that that's the ice around my heart melting. Because when I first came in, the only reason why I would cry is to get out of stuff and to manipulate you and make you feel bad for me. And today they're genuine tears, and they come all the time, which is really annoying. And it's a sign of growth. When I first came in, I was very talkative, and I could talk and bullshit you like crazy. And now it's like really hard because I know the kind of person that I was, and it wasn't a pretty sight. So I started drinking when I was 13. I had a pretty normal childhood. Nothing really big happened to me. I was almost too perfect in the beginning. You could tell me to take a nap and I'd go find a corner with my little blanket and pass out in 2 seconds, and no one could lie, no one could do anything bad, you know, and I would be the little tattletale sister. I'm the baby and the only girl, and I have two older brothers, and they never got away with anything when I was little. And then that perfect age stopped at about 5 when I went to school and interacted with other people. I don't know if that's because I wanted to impress other people or if I just, you know, broke free from my mother and had decided to rebel or what. But 5th grade, you know, I had already started getting into trouble. I would run around and kiss all the boys on the playground, and I would always be on the bench because I would get in trouble for kissing the boy. And, you know, stuff like that just kept happening. I'd get in trouble for lying. I'd get in trouble for saying bad words. And I was always in a lot of girl drama. And I was really badly bullied in 6th grade. No one would talk to me for like half the school year. And I would go to my mom's room and I would cry. And because she worked there. And that kind of made me start to people please. I started really wanting to make everyone like me. And it got harder and harder because people started to catch on that I was fake. I wasn't really me. I was always who you wanted me to be. And in high school, the summer before my freshman year, I decided I was going to try shots because my new high school meant party scene, and I didn't want to make a fool out of myself the first party I went to. So I was home alone. My drinking started alone, and I could remember this family friend person. I don't even know who he is anymore, but I remember him taking a shot of Jose Cuervo and saying, "Oh, this will put hair on your chest." And I don't know why that sounded appealing to me, because I really don't want hair on my chest, but I knew what he meant by it, that it was strong, and if I could handle Jose Cuervo, I could handle anything. And so that was my first drink. I grabbed a shot glass off my brother's collection of shot glasses, and I grabbed my parents' Jose Cuervo under the cabinet. I blared the radio to some party music, and I took my first shot, and I hated it. I hated the taste. It was disgusting. And but I liked the way it started to make me feel. And then I had to continue my little experiment and see how much I could drink without making a fool of myself. You know, it's all testing, you know. So I just kept going, and I'm not sure how many I took that day, but I just remember having a lot of fun by myself. You know, I was dancing around my living room, doing a little cleaning, I think. But I remembered that first drink, and it was fun. And after that, I started sneaking. I don't even think I went to a single party in my high school career. It was always drinking during school hours and hiding it in my room. I used to blame my mom and dad for not letting me go to parties, because if I just had that me time, I wouldn't have to do it during school hours, and that's just a bunch of bullshit. But, so I started getting into trouble more my sophomore year, ditching a lot, doing other extracurricular activities, drugs. I was a big pothead, and I drank a lot, and it was always during school hours. I never went to school, and if I did, I was always messed up. And it started getting me into a lot of trouble my senior year. My senior year, I got into a really bad car accident. I had been drinking, and you know, I don't remember exactly what happened, I have to say that, but I know that during the police report said that I told them that I tried to commit suicide. You know, I've heard different parts, and I don't remember, like my seatbelt was still on, so was I lying? I don't know, but I do know that I was in a dark place, and I don't remember anything really, except that I crashed my car and I ran from the scene. And they called my parents, and they told them that they needed to find me because I should be bleeding to death by the looks of the car. And that sent them in a panic. And they called me, and I do remember this. I was ready to jump in front of a car. And I told them that, and luckily before the car came, a police car pulled up right next to me, and my dad was on the other side in his truck. And when they found me, they almost didn't believe I was driving the car, because I only had a scratch on me and a seatbelt burn. And so I, that's one of the very few God moments that one of the few, wait. A lot of God moments, and that was just one of them. I don't know what anyway, but that was just one of them, you know, that was just proof that there was something bigger watching over me that night, and it was one of the times I said that I was never going to drink again, and they'd only lasted like a week, if that. And I was back on it. And the second really big thing that happened was that I put, I was babysitting, and I put four kids in the car with me after I was drinking their parents' liquor. And I backed up into a tree, and the housemaid's car. And I proceeded to drive about a block away until the little girl opened the door and said, "Let me out." And they were all screaming, and that was really hard. One of the things I never thought I would do is put kids in jeopardy, not my kids, and definitely not someone else's kids, and I did. And another time where I said I was never going to drink again, and that only lasted like 3 days, and I was back on it. And I had one moment of clarity after that. I had told myself that, you know, I was sitting in an alleyway, and I was drinking and smoking, and I thought, you know, what am I doing? You know, I'm with sketchy people that I know I wouldn't be talking to if I was sober. I'm in an alleyway and I'm drinking after I did these things, you know, and but it didn't matter at the time. And but that day I did go to a counseling appointment because I have been seeing this therapist since I was bullied in sixth grade. So my parents were going to kind of have a small intervention and tell me that, you know, there was something wrong with my drinking. And before they even said it, I said I needed help. And that was when I went to my first rehab. I was 17, and I went to a adolescent rehab, and it didn't work out because of me, you know. And I left there, and I went to another one, and lasted like 7 days, not even, and got kicked out again. And back up a little bit. When I first came back, my mom had come to this meeting, and she had come to learn more about what I was going through, and people welcomed her. Bill welcomed her and sent her to Al-Anon, where she got strength. And I'm truly grateful to people that were here that day, and she was here and helped her through it. And so when I came home, I went to a meeting, and I came here, and my mom said, "This is her," and Bill welcomed me and introduced me to some women, and I went to meetings every day, and I bullshitted every day. I lied for the first 4 months of my recovery and said I was sober and I wasn't. Again, those people-pleasing skills were coming out, and I wanted to be the best 17-year-old recovering alcoholic, you know, shining example that there could possibly be. And I would lie to you, and I would lie to my sponsor, and wife was my first sponsor, and I would tell her all of the things that I thought she wanted me to hear or wanted me to say, you know. My step work was never genuine. It was always what I thought you wanted to hear and to make me look good. And I would talk in meetings and I would say what, you know, I heard in the meeting last night, you know. And I never thought I needed to read the book because everyone talked about the book, so I already knew what was in the book. Turns out I didn't know shit about the book. So I then went into another rehab, and like I said, I got kicked out. I came back, which was the same sponsor. She caught me drinking, and while I was working on step work. Yeah, that's really smart, huh? She was like, "What's in your bag?" And there it was. When I came out about wine, about my whole sobriety time, and I still wouldn't get sober after that. I would have to go through two more sponsors, and I blamed them. It was their fault that they didn't keep me sober, and they didn't do their job right. Well, obviously it was me, the next big thing that like really happened to me was that I had this, you know, when we get that urge to drink and we don't have a higher power to rely on, there is nothing stopping us from going to any length to get that first drink or that first drug, and you'll think of anything. And I did one day, and I got that craving, and I left, and I went to the Oval because it was close, and I knew there would be alcohol and drugs there. And I stayed there for a little while. And that was my first time using needles. And I was 18 years old. I was staying the night in an abandoned house with this guy I had just met. And my morning coffee was a vodka bottle with a straw in it. And I was doing all the drugs you can think of. And my phone had died, so I had no outside communication. I had left my mom in a parking lot and took off. And she didn't know where I went. And I was there for a few days, and I woke up one night thinking, well, I went to the bathroom in this abandoned house, and we were sleeping in a closet, so I had to go out and go to the bathroom. And when I was washing my hands, I saw track marks up and down my arm. And I just remember thinking that I was going to die there. And that no one would know where I was. And for a moment, I was okay with that. I didn't care if I died, you know, as long as I didn't have to keep living that way. But then I thought of my family. And how heartbroken they'd be. So I decided the next day I would go to the Awano Club because it was nearby, and okay, I'm gonna stop crying. I decided I was gonna go to the Awano Club because it was not far and I could walk there, and I knew there was an 8 o'clock meeting, and I knew there was a noon meeting because I'd been in the program for a little while then. And well, around the program, not in the program. So I knew the times, and I said I would go to the noon because 8 was too early. I don't know what I was thinking because I wasn't sleeping. It's not like I needed to rest or I was going to sleep in. I wasn't eating or sleeping. So, and then the next morning I would walk to the rescue mission to get food. I'm not eating, so it doesn't really make sense. But the things we do, you know, we go through the motions to pretend like our life is okay. And the true reason that I think that I didn't want to go to that 8 o'clock meeting was because I wanted a last 6 in. And who knows, had I gotten that last 6 in, I probably would have died. I could have. And but when I was walking to that rescue mission, a girl was walking the opposite direction. And my friend, the guy that I was with, my friend, he wasn't my friend, the guy that I was, the guy that I was with said, hey, where are you going? And she said, the Awano Club for the 8 o'clock meeting. And I knew in my heart right then that God was telling me that I needed to get there at 8 o'clock, not noon. And so I took what he was telling me through this other person, because that's how I believe God works, is that he talks to me through people around me, whether they know they're being used by God or not. And so I went with her, and she was just going because she was on a fork card. She didn't want to get sober, so I didn't cry. I didn't tell her what I was feeling. And because those few days that I was there, I had already been scolded. You don't cry at the Oval. You don't show emotion. You just do what you have to do to survive. And so I didn't cry, and I walked there, but I felt inside like I was going to break apart at any moment. And I just prayed that I would make it to the Awano Club before I did. And so I got to the Awano Club, and I walked in, and I found a woman that I had talked to when I was around the program. And I pulled her outside, and I told her what was going on and where I was and what I had been doing. And I cried and cried and cried, because that's what we can do here, is show emotion and not be ashamed of it. And I cried, and she took me home. She cleaned me up. She gave me a shower. She gave me food, and she let me borrow a charger to charge my phone. And when my phone turned on, I had a million voicemails, all from my mom. And
She was crying and begging me to call her. Just so that she would know I was alive. And in my addiction, that doesn't matter. She doesn't matter. And, but it broke my heart because I had started to come down and I was feeling again. I called her, I told her I was alive, and I called my sponsor at the time, Mandy, and she met me at a meeting. And then after the meeting, I went with my mom, and I went home. And I don't really remember a lot, you know, I was still foggy, and I'm sure I apologized like I always do, making promises, and I still wouldn't get sober after that. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. I don't stop until I'm beaten down and almost dead. I would continue to drink, and one thing I know that I did right was that I never stopped coming back. Never. I mean, I would get drunk and the next day I'd be here. I would get drunk and that night I'd be here. And it wasn't good for you to see, but because I'd be drunk and I'm throwing up in the bathroom or, you know. I remember I was in, you know, the Rule 62 meeting that she was talking about, and I was drunk. And they have this bathroom where there's three stalls. Two of them are baby stalls. So the toilet seat is way to the ground. And the last one is the adult stall. Well, I was too drunk to know, so I took the baby stall. And my sponsor at the time had come in, and she's like, what are you doing? Because I'm, like, way on the ground. Like, you could see my, like, mouth not good. And, But I never stopped coming back. That's the point. Is that, and you know, maybe that's what saved me. Well, I know that's what saved me. Because a seed was planted whether I knew it or not. And whether I was willing to accept it or not. I knew where to go and I knew what to do. Just when I was willing was the question. I came to this meeting actually drunk, really drunk, and I was totally obnoxious outside, and I had people coming and talking to me, and they didn't know who I was, because I'm totally different when I drink, like totally different. I'm mean, I'm hateful, I'm pity me, I'm just awful, and I think I'm all that, but you know. I was telling people all my shit, you know, and Rayanne was there, and she didn't waste her time with me until after the meeting, and she came outside, and she sat, and she let me talk to her, and she let me tell her all of my shit, you know, all of the, you know, if this didn't happen, I wouldn't be drinking. If my mom was this way, I wouldn't be drinking. If my dad was this way, you know, everyone else was wrong but me. And it was everyone else's fault. And she listened, she smiled, she nodded, you know. And then when I was finally done, she said, you're full of shit. And walked away. And that was it. And the next day, I called her, and she was like, Rita, you called me. Like, I didn't think you'd call me after I said that to you. And I was like, well, that's what I need. And she became my sponsor after that, and I've had her since. And still wouldn't get sober yet. Almost there.
there's two more drunks. I got drunk again. I don't really remember when that. Oh, I was at CUS and I got drunk. And she was gonna pick me up and I stood her up because I was drunk. And the next time I got drunk, I was at an AA thing. Yeah, that's the best place to get drunk. Is that AA function? It's awful. Total buzzkill. I can remember, you know, being drunk and talking all about AA and how wonderful this place was, and you should go because it's cool, and being shit-faced, you know, and you're never the same after you come here, and that when you get drunk, you, it plays in your head, you know, the things that people tell you, and so I got drunk, my last drunk was at the first annual roundup in Fresno, and I made history, because I went back this year and they knew who I was, and they're like, I remember you, you were drunk last year, and I'm like, yes, that was me, but it's kind of cool going back and then knowing that that was my last drunk, and you know, it wasn't pretty. I don't really remember most of it. I just remember coming home and my mom was waiting outside. And she's so good at, you know, she's a manipulator too. In her own way. You know, she's like, your sponsor called me and she told me that you were drinking. And turns out my sponsor didn't call her. But she said it so I would come out and say, okay, yes, I was drinking. And she'd say, I told you so, your sponsor didn't call me, and, but you just pulled on yourself. So she did that throughout my whole drinking career. She'd tell me that she knew the facts and that I just needed to be honest, and she didn't know shit. She just needed me to tell her the truth. And I always fell for it, and all of us did, all us kids. But, so I came home and she took my bottle, like always, except she hid it in the trunk this time. But that's her story to tell. But I will tell you that a few months later she came into the program after she took my bottle. I came back in with my toe between my legs, although that wasn't anything new because I always did. You know, it describes that in the book. You know, it says how we truly, truly feel remorseful. And when we say it, we mean it. You know, I'm never going to drink again. I really meant it and I really felt that way, but I didn't know how to not drink. And it turns out it's really simple. We have a simple set of instructions, numbered 1 through 12 for a reason. You know, you don't start off and jump to 9 and start making amends. You start at 1 and you work your way to 12. And the steps I have found that they're meant not so that your sponsor can get you sober, but that your sponsor can lead you to a higher power that can. And, you know, this is just a way to clear that road or that pathway for him to enter into your heart and regain that conscious contact with him. And, you know,
I started working the steps truly. After that last drunk, I called her every day. I did exactly what she told me to do. I was, when I came in, I was absolutely incapable of being honest with every little thing. I mean, my mom would ask me, did you eat this morning? And I'd say yes when I didn't. And, it was little things like that I couldn't even be honest with. So how was I supposed to be honest with the big things? Well, this last time around, I had to get rigorously honest, meaning if I'm not honest, come back and tell the truth. It's not easy to just break that habit. That's not what we're saying, is to just fix it like that. It takes time and it takes practice, but it takes, owning up to your shit and saying, you know what, I was wrong and I'm sorry and I told you a lie the other day. And it's not easy, but you have to swallow your pride because, that ego shit that we had before didn't help us at all. It just made things worse. And I had to really get, when I did step one again, I had to really look at the doctor's opinion. I had to really look at exactly what I was getting myself into, because we come in and we're so eager to say, Alyssa, alcoholic, that we don't even know what alcoholism is. And, when you read it, you learn about yourself a little bit better. And if it's you, then you need to take every action that you can and, and totally admit that you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is unmanageable. And what does that mean? It means that, for me, powerlessness is that once I get that craving, I can't stop. If no one matters, I'll run you over. And once I start, I can't stop. That's for sure. For me, there is no point in taking one drink. I didn't like the taste. I only liked the effect. And one drink isn't going to get me the effect that I wanted. So, once I started, I can't stop. And my life was unmanageable because my life was run by alcohol. It was totally wrapped up in, where I was going to get the money, steal from whoever is around me, steal from stores, all that. When can I? My mom goes to work at 8. She doesn't come home till 1. I want to be a little bit sober when she comes home so I'm not looking stupid. All of that stuff. I'm thinking, of how to get away with it all day long. And I'm losing my relationship, my trust, my freedom. I thought I wanted freedom by being able to drink. Turns out that's not at all freedom, because alcohol put me in a prison that I couldn't even see and I wanted to be in. It's like closing a prison door and it not being locked. You can walk out when you choose to, but we choose to stay in it. Step two wasn't hard for me. I knew there was a God based on, the things that had happened to me. One thing, that's really big. After the Oval, I was sharing needles with people that I didn't know in bathrooms and, in really sketchy situations. And I went to the doctor after that and got tested for AIDS and Hep C and all that good stuff. And my test results came back that I had Hep C. And I was devastated, but I was okay. I knew that God was going to do with me what he wanted. And I just prayed for the strength to go through it. Then I went back to the doctor to get my genotype, which is like what stage you're in. I went back and he got me lab work and I did the lab work and I came back and he said that you're one of those rare cases where your body was exposed to Hep C, but your body rejected it. And that was God saying, this is what your will do for you. You'll get Hep C, you'll get all these really bad stuff, and this is what I can do. I can stop that from happening if you'll let me. And so I am Hep C free, and that's all.
only by the grace of God. It truly is. So that was another God moment, you know, that all of these things had been happening around me that I didn't realize, you know, I didn't see that as God just yet. You know, I had to really look back and see exactly where He was working in my life. And when you look back, it's everywhere. And we just choose to ignore it. And so it wasn't hard for me to come to terms with my God. I had believed in Him. I just didn't think I was worthy or that I could do anything for Him. And, you know, but moving towards step 3 and 4 and 5, I got to start forgiving myself. 3 is an everyday thing. Well, 1, 2, and 3 are. I constantly have to give things over to God. It's not just an open one day, you know, thing. You know, sometimes I try and take it back and I try and do my own thing. And I have to give it back because things turn out shitty. And, but we're human, that's what we do. It's whether you're aware of it or not. And 4 and 5 really just helped me get all that shit out that was, you know, in order for God to really come into my life, I had to make room for Him. Because I have a lot of crap built up inside me that He wouldn't fit. And that's why I love when Albert says, you know, I had to die to live. I really did, you know, because the person I was had to be completely gone before I could be reborn and into the person He wanted me to be. And 6 and 7, my character defects, you know, I have a lot of them, and they're always there. You know, when we say the 7-step prayer, it talks about, you know, how we ask that He removes those that are keeping me from doing His will. And, you know, that doesn't mean all of them. You know, it only means the ones that are in the way at the time. And sometimes it's all the time, sometimes it's not. And it's being aware of them and knowing that they're there. And, you know, my sponsor had me write a list of, you know, what my character defects are and what I would like the opposite to be, you know, so if I was a liar, I wanted to be honest, you know, those types of things. And it helped me see, you know, where I had flaws and what I could do to fix it. 8 and 9, I'm still doing 9. It's a daily thing, you know, I mean, you can't just set a week aside and make all your amends. I made my amends my mom last month. You know, I kept waiting for the perfect moment. You know, I'll take her on a picnic. I'll take her to dinner. You know, and then we went on a trip this last weekend, and I wanted to make my amends on the beach, and it didn't happen because I fell asleep tanning. But the perfect moment is when you make it. And, you know, it was in the car, and we were driving, and wasn't amazing, like scenery or anything, but it was what it was, and we had that deep heart-to-heart conversation, and it was perfect, the way God wanted it to be. And I made my amends to some other family members, and you know, more people will come into my life in the right time, and the point is that I'm willing to make them, and when the time is right. And you know, 10 is like all the time. You know, I make mistakes all the time. All the time. And it sucks. You know, you don't want to have to make amends on a daily basis and say that you're wrong, but it is what it is, and you have to do it just so that you can have that peace of mind and that serenity that alcohol gave me at first. 11, you know, I'm always in conscious contact with God. I am. Without Him, I wouldn't be standing here. And it's my job now to give back and, you know, be a vessel for Him. And, you know, people get freaked out at the word God, but God is whoever you choose for Him to be. You know, God is this empty word that you can fill with anything that you want. And
It doesn't have to be Jesus Christ or Buddha or whatever. It is who you choose him to be, and he will be revealed if you work the steps. And 12, I try and do that. I mean, I'm really good at doing that because I love people. And I want to help. And there's no such thing as a lost cause. And there's always hope because I was there. A lot of people didn't think I'd make it. They hoped that I would, but a lot of them have told me, you know, if you drink again, I'm scared that I'll be at your funeral. And sometimes I feel that way with other people that I see going in and out of the room, and I get scared. But then I remember my story and how long it took me to get here, but I'm here. So there is never a loss. There is always hope. And you can do it. Just keep coming back and keep that open mind and that honesty and willingness. It's not always easy, but it's definitely worth it. My relationships are so much better today. My relationship with myself is so much better today. You know, I love who I am today. And my mom, she's my best friend today. We do everything together, which is a little scary sometimes because we'll finish each other's sentences or say the same thing at the same time in the exact same way, and it's kind of scary. But we didn't have that before, and for a long time it looked like we would never have that. And today it's better than I could ever have dreamed of, and that's because God is in the middle. And we both have faith, and we have faith in him first. And you know, I'm just really grateful, and you know, this program works if you give it a chance. And it's no one else's fault but your own. Take what we have. And we're here to give it. Thank you.